I invite you to open the Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 17 today, as we tell the story of Saul becoming officially the first king of united Israel. Now, we already know the backstory, that the people of Israel are nervous about Samuel being older now. He's right around 60 or so. And he has two sons that are supposed to be assisting him in judging the nation of Israel, but they're not as devoted as he. Israel is experiencing some pressures from the Philistines on the west and some pressures from Nahash the Ammonite on their eastern border. And so they came to Samuel and told him, "You're old, your sons are not as good as you, we want a king. We want a physical king to save us and lead us, just like all the other nations have." Samuel was insulted, but when he talked to God about it, God said, "You're not the problem, they're the problem. They are insulting me because they don't want me to be their king." He then proceeded to have Samuel warn the people that the type of king that they wanted, a tyrant of sorts, or a tyrant in the making, would be somebody they would cry over later. But they insisted, and so God has now designated the sort of guy they were looking for. It's a man of Benjamin. His name is Saul. He's probably somewhere in his 40s. That means he's likely to be a veteran of the War of Ebenezer 20 years earlier. He is strong and handsome. He's at least 6 or so inches taller than the average Israeli. He's probably up in the lower part of the 6-foot range. And he's the one that Samuel has privately anointed as king and given him supernatural signs that God is giving him this job. Well, Saul does not share any of that information with any of his relatives. He keeps it to himself. All of that probably happened in the first half of the Jewish year that started in the spring of 1037 BC. And that brings us then probably to the 7th month or so of 1037 BC, when the Israelis would have already been gathering together for their tabernacle celebration, their festival of harvest and thankfulness to God. The reason I believe that the coronation of the king took place at that time is because in the history of Israel, there seems to be an association of Tishri 1, that is the first day of the 7th Jewish month in the fall, as the annual day of the king, his day of kingship, his annual anniversary. So I believe that more than likely we're looking at something that happened on the first day of the 7th month in 1037 BC. 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 17. "Now Samuel called the people together to he who is at Mitzpah." Now Mitzpah it's been a traditional assembly point of the Israelis for many events in the past. It's only a matter of a few miles from where Saul grew up. In fact, it's about 3 miles west of Gibeah. It's also about 1 mile south of Gibeon, which is where, at some point during the judgeship of Samuel, the second version of the tabernacle has been erected. And the people of God are going to that site to worship. Now, the Ark of the Covenant is a few miles southwest of there at another city, the city of Kiriath Yearim. And for some reason that's never expressed clearly, I think it's actually kind of a personal difference of opinion. The people at Kiriath Yearim won't bring the ark to Gibeon, and the people at Gibeon won't bring the tabernacle to Kiriath Yearim. So we've entered into this very weird situation where you've got two different key worship sites. But that's actually not the worst of it. The Israelis have gotten into the habit of worshiping at all sorts of different worship sites. It seems that every key city of a region has a high place with a sacrificial altar, and they regionally are worshiping God. And God seems to just allow that by permission because of, well, the Israelis just being the way they are right now. Okay, so more than likely, in my opinion, they're being brought together near the tabernacle for this annual assembly. And Samuel has something very specific in mind for this one. Verse 18, he said to the people of Israel, thus says he who is the God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But today you have rejected your God who saves you from all your calamities and your distresses, and you have said to him, set a king over us. Now therefore present yourselves before he who is by your tribes and by your thousands. So this ceremony starts with a reminder, you guys asked for this as part of your continued rebellion against the God who brought you out of Egypt and saved you over the last four centuries of his care for you. So you're about to get what you deserve. You're going to get the leader you asked for. Verse number 20. Now, the way it's going to happen is this is going to be kind of a public revelation through the lot. Through the divine lot. Now, it's interesting that the Urim and the Thummim is not being used here because we don't know why. It will be used later under Saul and under David, but it's not being used for this ceremony. Instead, the divine lot, which comes from the book of Proverbs, it says, the lot is cast into the lap, but every decision belongs to the Lord. So they pray, and then they are going to dump out of a container one marker with the name of a tribe on it. So here we go. Verse 20, Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. So Benjamin is identified as the tribe from which this king is going to come. And that's interesting because this is the smallest of the tribes right now, because only a matter of a few generations ago, it was nearly wiped out. There were only 600 men left in it. And so here it is being designated as the first king's tribe. So now they take all of kind of the clan names of the tribe of Benjamin. They put that in the container and pray about it. He brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its clans, and the clan of the Matrites was taken by lot. And then they start going by families. And they take the family of Kish, And then they're going to go by the sons of Kish. And it says here that Saul, the son of Kish, was taken by Lot. But when they sought him, he could not be found. So they're looking around for him going, where are you? Your name was called. Where are you at? So they inquired again of he who is there a man still to come? And he who is said, behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage. Now that sounds more like the Urim and the Thummim being used, because it's having some sort of yes-no question that is asked. And the Urim and Thummim, I believe probably one of the stones glows to show the answer. So is he here at Mitzpah? Yes. Where is he at? Is he in his tent? No. Is he taking care of animals? No. Is he where everybody keeps the baggage? Yes. And so they use this to track him down. Verse 23, when they ran and took him from there, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. Remember, I've talked about that before. Based on the length of a cubit, which is from the elbow to the tip of the finger, being 18 inches during this time period of Israel's history, that would seem to indicate the average height of an Israeli male was about 5'9", 5'10", somewhere in that range. And so for Saul to be about 6 inches taller than that puts him in the low 6-foot range. So he is impressive by his height. So verse 24, Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom he who is has chosen? There is none like him among the people. So this is the guy you were looking for. You wanted somebody tall and handsome and strong and a warrior, someone that looks regal. Well, here he is. And all the people shouted, long live the king. Literally, they say, life to the king, live the king. Verse 25, then Samuel told the people the rights and duties of the kingship. Now, you remember that's what he warned them about a few weeks earlier. He's going to draft your young men into his army and into his military industrial complex. He's going to draft your young women into service to his ever-expanding royal palace. And he's going to tax you 10%. And he's going to confiscate your best stuff and give it to his main supporters to keep their loyalty to him. So he's going to basically turn into a tyrant. So he writes all that stuff down again. He wrote them in a book and laid it up before he who is. So this is a permanent record, a warning that this is not going to end well. Then Samuel sent all the people away, each one to his home. And Saul also went to his home at Gibeah. And with him went men of valor whose hearts God had touched. So Saul has now become the king of Israel. But what do you do with that? Israel is divided up into 12 tribes, and then the 13th tribe, the tribe of Levi, is scattered in service amongst all those different tribes. They stretch from Dan to Beersheba, and from in some places, the coastline of the Mediterranean, all the way over to the border with the Ammonites on the eastern side of the Jordan. So it's scattered all over the place. How's he supposed to lead that? Well, that's not become clear yet. So everybody goes back to where they were from, and he goes back to his town of Gibeah, which is, you know, just only 3 miles from where they just had this ceremony. And he takes with him some volunteers that become kind of his first bodyguard, his first military corps that want to serve him, that God has kind of designated to be around him. However, not everybody is on board with this. Verse 27, but some worthless fellows, and this is that whole idea that they're the sons of Belial, they're scum. They are guys that are not even worth having a physical body. That's how bad they are. Some worthless fellows said, how can this man save us? So they don't like him. Now, more than likely, the problem is they didn't get chosen. You know how it works in politics. You know how it works in positions of power. If you were wanting the position and it went to somebody else, you don't like them. And so that's where these guys are out. And they despised him and brought him no present. So the tradition, borrowed probably from the nations around them, was when your king came to the throne, you sent something to show you appreciated him, some sort of present, some sort of gift. Well, these guys refused to do so. Now, these are not some sort of random guys. These are probably leaders in the regions of the tribes. And Saul held his peace. So even though he's been insulted by these guys, at this point, he keeps his powder dry. He keeps his mouth shut. Now, he does apparently show a little bit of humility at the beginning here. That seems to be the reason why he was over by the baggage, is that even though he knew he was designated by Samuel the prophet as the anointed king, and that that was what was going to happen at this ceremony, he was in the wings. He was restrained. And that's good. And he is told later that if he'd kept that attitude, he would have succeeded. But the reality is, God knows how he's going to react to the power he's receiving. And that is why I keep stressing this idea that from the very beginning, God warned them that this first king was going to be a bad situation. He was going to be the sort of king they wanted and therefore deserved. And when things went sideways, don't come crying to God, because he told you ahead of time, this is the way it's going to work. Chapter number 11. Now, as I told you, I think that Saul became king somewhere around the time of Feast of Tabernacles in 1037 BC. And it is possible that later in that same year, or possibly over the winter and into the spring of the next year, that's when things heated up on the eastern border. That Nahash the Ammonite decided that since the Israelis were starting to organize themselves around a new leader, that he better make a move to confiscate the eastern territories for himself. And so in chapter number 11, it says that then Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. Now, Jabesh-Gilead is located about 22 miles or so south of the Sea of Galilee, on the eastern side of the Jordan Valley. And more importantly for us, it's tied in with the Benjamite tribe. Because when the Benjamite tribe was nearly annihilated and came down to only 600 men, 400 women from Jabesh-Gilead, which was punished for not participating in a bit of warfare back at that time. 400 women from this city became the wives of Benjamites. So 2/3 of the new Benjamite families are related immediately to this city. So now, several generations later, it's guaranteed that everybody in Benjamin is somehow related into this city. They've got distant relatives in this city. And so it's no doubt to me that Saul would have felt a personal affinity to this city. And so all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a treaty with us. We'll serve you." So they surrender to him, or are willing to surrender to him, if he will just set some terms, you know, like how much grain does he want? How much wool? How much sheep or olive oil or wine does he want every year? But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, "On this condition I'll make a treaty with you, that you gouge out your right eye and thus bring disgrace on all Israel." So he's mean. He says, "No, you know what I want? I want you all to poke out your right eyes and shame yourselves. That would make me happy." The elders of Jabesh said to him, "Give us 7 days respite that we may send messengers through all the territory of Israel. Then if there's no one to save us, we will give ourselves up to you. So let us have 7 days to see if a hero will step forward and save us from you. Somebody that'll come and take you on militarily. If nobody steps forward, fine, we'll poke out our right eyes and become your slaves." When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, they reported the matter in the ears of the people, and all the people wept aloud. Now, why did they come here? Well, obviously, because this is where their new king lives. Now, he's still acting like he did the year before. He's just going through agricultural activities. Verse 5, "Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen." So he's been out there working with oxen, perhaps plowing or maybe threshing. And Saul said, "What's wrong with the people that they're weeping?" And so they told him the news of the men of Jabesh. The Spirit of God rushed upon Saul when he heard these words, and his anger was greatly kindled. Now, this is a slightly different phrasing that we've seen before about the supernatural Holy Spirit empowerment of a judge. And so God gives him what he needs to act as the military leader here. And so he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." So he sends out this quick message calling people to a blood oath of service in the militia. If you don't show up, you're going to lose your own oxen. And so the dread of he who is fell upon all the people, and they came out as one man. And when he mustered them at Bezek, which we don't know exactly where Bezek is, it's probably up north of Shechem a little ways, probably on this road that goes from Shechem to Bethshan, which would connect there in the lower Jezreel Valley with a west-east road that would go across the Jordan River at Jabesh-Gilead. So probably somewhere up in the hill country of Manasseh. So the people of Israel that were mustered up were 300,000, and the men of Judah, 30,000. Interesting that Judah's mustering numbers are given separately from the rest of Israel. They said to the messengers who had come, "Thus shall you say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance. And when the messengers came and told the men of Jabesh, they were glad. And they said, tomorrow we'll give ourselves up to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you. So we're now set up for the first military action taken by King Saul with a matter of months of him becoming the king of Israel.